I'm here today with Greg Linden, who runs the popular Geeking with Greg blog on large-scale machine learning, data mining, and things like that. And also the guy who did the first recommender systems at Amazon, the thing that tells people who like this book, like whatever. So, you know, let's start with your Amazon experience. So, was this something that you got into right out of college, or how did you come about inventing the recommender system for Amazon?
Well, right, I came to Amazon right out of University of Washington and joined the company when it was small. It was still just a little online bookstore, and when I joined, it was growing so rapidly, it was all we could do to keep the wheels on the bus. We were just trying to keep up with the incredibly rapid growth of the system.
Yeah, I remember, Amazon, I think, really led the way in A-B testing as well. Mm. But, really the recommender systems, I think, was, one of the key critical assets. So so what was your background in school that led you into this? Or, how did you come up with the idea?
Well, I was working in the artificial intelligence group at University of Washington with Dan Weld and Orin Etzioni, who are still there, Steve Hanks, who's now at Tacoma. And I was fascinated with the recommender systems at the time before I went to Amazon. At that time, that was Firefly, which was a movie recommender. You would rate movies, and it would recommend other movies you might be interested in.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So after the experience at Amazon, what was your next step?
Well, after Amazon, I did a startup for about 4 years. It was a startup called Findery, yep. And it was a news recommendation site. So as you read news articles, it recommended other news articles you might be interested in. A little like Google News, but it changed as you read more articles, changed and adapted based on what you did. The general idea behind Findery was to do Amazon-like recommendations, but not for products, but for information. Yep. So Findery was trying to recommend information based on your past behavior.
While you were doing Findery, you kept up the Geeking with Greg blog. Mm-hmm. If people don't know, you've recently joined Microsoft. It appears that you're keeping up that blog.
Yeah, people seem to find the blog surprisingly useful. What I try to do is track trends in the industry or technical papers that I'm reading anyway as part of my work, and then the write-up both helps me and seems to help other people.
Cool.
It's surprisingly popular.
So can you talk very much about what you're doing at Microsoft?
Only in generic terms. I'm working mostly on search and advertising. I have a pretty strong interest in personalized search and personalized advertising. So that would be, to take personalized search as an example, that would be different search results for different people depending on their past behavior.
Right.
Now, when you do a search and I do a search, we see the same results.
Right.
But what personalized search wants to do is relax that assumption. So you do a search, and based on everything you did, the results might reorder. When I do a search, that might say that I'm interested in certain things, and my results would reorder. So we'd see different results.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating topic. You know, with the experience you mentioned with Findery doing, say just recent news, that's not really a search where somebody's actually searching, where with Amazon, I might actually be searching for a book and find related books. Let's talk a little bit about some news about some of the competition / partners out there.
Okay.
So one of the recent headlines has been about Yahoo switching over some of their search infrastructure or all of their search infrastructure to run on Hadoop.
Mm-hmm.
So, for people in the audience and even for me, can you talk a little bit about what is Hadoop and why that's an interesting piece of news?
Sure. So Hadoop is a open source clone of Google's MapReduce infrastructure. So MapReduce is a system that's designed for very large-scale data processing. The idea is to be able to process petabytes of data, which is, unbelievably
yep.
enormous amounts of data, over thousands or tens of thousands of machines. And when Google came up with this, people became very interested. They published a few papers about the size and scale of things that they were able to do. And Hadoop is one of several, actually, attempts to reproduce that infrastructure.
Okay, cool. So, you know, the MapReduce architecture is really, you know, seems extremely simplistic. You know, you pass it some, you know, a function that you know, maps over a list of data, then you pass another function that kind of aggregates that all up and gives you some kind of result. So obviously it's worked well for Yahoo. You know, they've announced that they've put their search infrastructure on it. Mm-hmm. But there's been a little bit of, you know, controversy out there with, you know, people like Michael Stonebreaker coming out and saying, you know, yeah, MapReduce is great, but it's not as cool as SQL, and it's not that powerful. You can't use it for many things. Mm-hmm. So what's your take on that?
Well, I think it's true that what you can express in MapReduce is relatively limited. But it turns out that what you can express in MapReduce is also quite an interesting subset of the things you want to do. And from the simplicity of MapReduce, it allows it, it makes it much easier to scale over this very large number of nodes and this very large amount of data. I don't know of anyone who successfully scaled, you know, an SQL database over tens or hundreds of thousands of nodes and operating over petabytes of data the same way that that Google's MapReduce does. It's difficult to support these very expressive computations over large numbers of nodes. You have to deal with some very complicated failure scenarios, and the simplicity of MapReduce makes it much easier to make it reliable and robust.
Yep.
Now, I mean, the reason why people are so interested in these tools like MapReduce is that it allows companies like Google or Yahoo with Hadoop to do things that they just simply couldn't do before. What's possible and what's impossible depends on your tools. What you consider possible depends on your tools. And what you consider low-hanging fruit depends on your tools. You know, the size of your ladder matters for what you think is easy to reach. And having a structure like MapReduce for Google allows them to process very, very large data sets in a way that just wasn't possible before.
Yeah. In fact, we've heard, you know, that employees at either one of these organizations, you know, almost on a whim can say, you know, I'd like to process job X and enlist thousands of machines to, you know, mm-hmm. to get an answer back. So that's definitely lowers the barriers to some, you know, interesting things.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Microsoft also has something that's a little bit like MapReduce. The Silicon Valley research team, the Microsoft research team down in Silicon Valley, has published several papers on a system called Dryad.
Yep.
One of the things that's interesting about that is that the team is talking a lot about how it's much more expressive than MapReduce. It allows a lot of computations that are not easy to express in the MapReduce framework.
You know, this leads to kind of the next area I wanted to ask about, which is this, you know, trend towards HPC and, you know, towards doing jobs on these, you know, either, you know, multi-core or, you know, machines that have 64 and 128 CPUs, you know, being put in at, you know, say banks and, mm-hmm. you know, brokerage houses and things like this. So do you see things like, you know, Hadoop, Dryad, MapReduce being the way that people will go, or do you see, you know, people moving back towards, you know, large data centers with, you know, many node HPC clusters?
Well, I think it depends on the task. I mean, I think where MapReduce and things like Hadoop really shine is when you're doing very large-scale data processing, data mining, machine learning, in situations where larger amounts of data help. It turns out there's a fair number of these. I mean, more data often seems to help more than a change in algorithm. And so this is why people are so interested in operating over petabytes of data. But that doesn't mean that all tasks necessarily fit into this framework and that everything is going to shift toward MapReduce. It just happens to be the case that a lot of problems that are encountered in search, a lot of the optimization that you want to do to a search engine, that you're looking for when you're trying to do a relevance rank for a search engine, that those kind of problems are extremely well suited to a MapReduce framework.
Sure. So I think, you know, there's another factor that people often cite when they talk about things moving into the cloud, and mm-hmm. that's really that, you know, when you're at the scale of, you know, an Amazon, or you're at the scale of, you know, particularly at the scale of a Google or Microsoft, where we have, you know, some of the largest data centers in the world, that the electricity bill and the bandwidth bill are significantly cheaper, and you know that even the storage bill is going to be a lot cheaper for these petabytes of information.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's people out there who are making claims that, you know, everything will get sucked into the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just the economics of people running their own data centers for data mining purposes and so on is just too prohibitively expensive.
Mm.
So how do you feel about those kind of predictions?
Well, I mean, I think there are advantages to having your computation in the cloud. There's advantages for sharing and collaboration to having your data be moved off into the network. I think one big question is with this is going to be, where is the master copy of your data going to be stored? You know, are you working on documents that live on someone else's computer off in the network, or do the documents live on your computer but are then replicated out to the network just for backup and sharing and collaboration? I think that's probably the big split. As far as large-scale data mining, I mean, I think anyone doing operations over petabytes of data, you know, anyone who wants to operate tens of thousands of machines is probably going to find it more effective to manage that themselves, if only because they're going to want to optimize the task, optimize the machines to their particular task.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're saying that when you're operating at that scale anyway, that you're going to want to tune things, you know. Yeah, and that is true. I mean, even a tweak to an algorithm could lower your electricity bill significantly, right?
So yeah, I don't think we're at the point yet where generic hardware kind of works for all purposes. I mean, some tasks are going to be very memory intensive, and you're going to want more memory per box. Some, you know, maybe using huge amounts of disk, and you still end up needing to optimize the infrastructure, I think.
Right.
And that only makes sense if you're at very large scale. So smaller players will use these services. But I think, you know, the Microsofts and the Yahoos of the world are going to always have their own.
One thing I've always found interesting, just watching this industry over the past 10 years, is that, you know, from the artificial intelligence people and so on, it seemed like a lot of people used to believe in all this taxonomy and ontology, and that mm-hmm. we'd be able to build these great big knowledge bases that would structure everything and give us the intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there started to be this shift towards machine learning. But tagging is an area that comes up as kind of an in-between space there, where you have, you know, people just creating tags and folksonomies and so on. What's your feeling about how useful are tags really for these purposes?
Well, I think tagging is really useful when you don't have any other information. So it's particularly useful for things like images or videos, where it's very difficult to extract information from those. I mean, with videos, you can try to do speech to text over them and then extract from
right.
that translation, but that's pretty difficult to do well. And with images, you really don't have any description of the image, any tags at all on the image. So I think tagging is an interesting, kind of clever, collaborative way of generating meta information about these kinds of things where there isn't other information. Where I tend to be really skeptical is when there already is a lot of information that can be extracted. So documents, for example, tagging on documents hasn't taken off very well.
Right.
But I think the primary reason for that is that you can already automatically generate very high-quality tags just doing an automated extraction.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so you know, moving beyond that, let's say, you know, you have all of this information. You know, you can extract stuff from documents. You've got search history logs, you know, people's browser logs, all this other kinds of stuff that you can use to build intelligent systems. So do you want to talk a little bit about where you see the limits of personalization?
Well, I think we're actually still in the early days of personalization. I think there's huge amounts of low-hanging fruit around. I mean, of course, personalization is trying to solve this very hard problem. It's basically trying to infer from very limited information what you might be interested in, even though you haven't said it explicitly. So it's going to be wrong fairly frequently, but it can still bring a fair amount of value. I mean, if you look at the alternative to personalizing the Amazon homepage, it would be just showing a list of top sellers, probably. I mean, what else can you do? And that's not very useful. It's much more useful to focus in on the areas I tend to be interested in and surface items from the catalog in those areas. With search in particular, I mean, I think we've barely started trying to personalize search results. At the moment, on all the major search engines, with just a few exceptions, everyone sees the same search results, no matter what they did in the past, no matter who they are. And I think just starting to relax that assumption could get us some interesting gains.
Oh, okay. So you do see potential in the, you know, even in applying it to search.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, I mean, I think search and recommendations do serve different purposes, which is why I see so much potential. Search is about finding. You know what you want. You're explicitly looking for it.
Right.
Personalization can help with discovery when you're not quite sure what you want and you're trying to bump into something that might be of interest. To take an example here, at Amazon, a lot of people come to Amazon, they search for a book, they buy that book, they check out, they're gone. And you don't want to get in those people's, you don't want to get in their way.
Right.
You want to just let them do that. But some people come to Amazon and they don't quite know what they want. And that's an opportunity to help them discover items from the catalog that might be of interest.
You know, I think the example you give of recommender systems is good because it seems like those tend to power scenarios where somebody's maybe making a transaction. You know, they're buying a ringtone or they're buying a book or something like that. You know, whereas search is definitely more tied to ad revenues. Mm. So, you know, the next question I wanted to ask is, in this space, you know, this space is just heating up and there's, you know, all kinds of interesting research and you know, things going on with the personalization and recommender and data mining and so on. What do you see as being the main business drivers for this in the industry?
Well, I mean, most of these companies seem focused around advertising. A vast majority of Google's revenue, I think it's over 99%, comes from advertising. But I guess I don't see that as a bad thing necessarily. I think that that advertising has a long way to go. If you think about the goal of advertising, I think it's to get useful products and services, information about useful products and services in front of people, and doing that in a more fine-grained, targeted way is how Google made all of its money. Before Google, Alta Vista was essentially just showing mass market advertising. And then Google with AdWords introduced this idea of, well, let's target the advertisements very closely to the search results and made the advertisements very relevant and useful.
Right.
And I think there's much further to go with making advertisements more targeted, more relevant, more useful to people and help them find information they need.
Yeah.
So I don't think we've gotten anywhere near the end of the road on where we can get with advertising.
You know, all this money that used to be going to print media flowing into this, you know, online advertising, and that'll be interesting.
It's a huge industry, and I think right now advertisements are not very relevant. They aren't very interesting and aren't very useful, and I think there's a long way to go to make them relevant, interesting, and useful.
Okay, great. So, you know, for the people watching, I would say just pay attention to Greg's blog, and you can follow along as he covers these issues. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.